KaiserNetwork.org.
The value of the payroll taxes paid on those HSA contributions. Coupled with that, the President is proposing to raise the contribution limits that can be put into the health savings account each year. As Diane correctly pointed out earlier, the contributions to the HSA are currently limited to the policy deductible under the high deductible plan that the individual chooses, but not all policies pay 100% after you hit your deductible. And certainly in her example, she showed a very common situation where people would pay 20% of their health expenses up until they hit an out-of-pocket maximum under their policy. The President is proposing that the individuals would be able to put enough into their HSA to cover all of their out-of-pocket expenses. So not only the deductible, but also those 20% coinsurance expenses up to their out-of-pocket maximum under their policy. This will give individuals who are chronically ill a way with tax advantages to get to cover all of their out-of-pocket expenses and get the tax savings for those contributions to the account, as well as forgot what I was going to say. Apologize for that. Oh, I know. For healthier individuals in a particular year, be able to put aside additional savings from one year to the next so that they can build up their account balance for future anticipated expenses. Let me briefly run through the other proposals that the President has put on the table before I turn to Kate and have her talk about the impact of the President's proposals. He would allow employers to make additional contributions to the health savings accounts of workers who have a chronic illness or condition or may have a family member with a chronic illness or condition. Today, the tax rules do not allow that. Employers have to treat all of their employees equally. So if I put $100 each month into my employees' health savings accounts, I pretty much have to do that for everyone. Employers have asked us for this flexibility, and the President has proposed to give that to them. Some employers took advantage of the Treasury regulations in 2002 and offered health reimbursement arrangements, which were a little bit of a precursor to HSAs. Some of them would like the ability to convert those over to HSAs and move forward with their benefits under an HSA structure. They can't do that with us allowing them to convert those policies over to HSAs. Next, we would allow individuals to actually pay their health insurance premiums out of their health savings accounts funds, which today you can't do unless you're receiving federal or state unemployment compensation or have COBRA continuation coverage. We're not sure why Congress limited it to those two situations, but certainly early retirees would benefit from being able to pay their health insurance premiums since they won't likely qualify for the other two. Also, for individuals who are just getting started with their accounts, we want to make sure that nobody gets caught by the IRS. So we're clarifying that they can open their account and make their contributions through April 15th of the following year and reimburse the expenses they've incurred up to that point. The last proposal I want to make you aware of is the President's refundable tax credit proposal for low-income Americans. Offering up to $1,000 refundable tax credit for individuals, $3,000 for families. This year, we modified the proposal that they must buy a HSA policy in order to qualify for the credit. The President felt that it has not gone very far in the Congress and felt that retooling it to make it consistent with the rest of our HSA proposals was consistent with that. Let me turn to Kate. She'll talk about some of the economic impact of the President's proposals.
Great, thanks. Now, as Roy mentioned at the beginning, the goal of this proposal is to put all sorts of healthcare consumption on equal footing, Right now, if you consume health care that you get through an employer health insurance account, that's subsidized by tax dollars. But if you consume care outside of that employer insurance, it's not subsidized. So you have incentives to get more and more employer-provided insurance instead of paying for routine care out of pocket. If you paid for routine care out of pocket, you would be a more cost-conscious, sensitive consumer. But if you had a high-deductible health policy to go along with it, you would have financial protection against the risk of potentially high expenditures. So think about your home insurance or your auto insurance. You have insurance against unexpected, catastrophic events that would be a real financial hardship to you, but you do not have insurance against things like oil changes or, you know, cleaning your house or cleaning out your gutters. If you did have insurance against those, you would consume a lot more of them, and there would be a lot less competition among providers to get you the best value, the best quality service that you could. We want to make health insurance look a little bit more like that through these proposals. But that might raise some questions in your mind. You might be worried, well, what happens to people who have employer insurance? Are these proposals really going to lower costs through the healthcare system? How much good are they going to do, and how much are they going to hurt potentially low-income people who are facing these high deductibles or sick people? But we'd like to address those concerns. First of all, I'd like to convince you that moving to this approach really could rein in spending. So some of you might be thinking, wow, if I had a high deductible health policy, maybe I would pay attention to the first $1,000 of spending, but all of our healthcare dollars are spent by people with really high expenditures. We've all heard that. 80% of the healthcare dollars are spent by the people with the 20% highest spending, and that's true. So you might think, well, gee, are these accounts going to do any good in getting people to put resources towards the highest value use? The answer is yes. In fact, because of that cost sharing that we talked about, the typical person with a high deductible health policy would be aware of how much health insurance or health consumption costs, up to about $12,000. Well, more than half of healthcare spending is done by people with less than $12,000 a year of spending. So people have plenty of skin in the game. People have an incentive to pay attention to their health expenditures when they have a policy like this. Also, these are not meant to replace all the other cost containment tools that we have at our disposal. You might think, gee, insurance companies do a better job of negotiating with providers than individual people can. Yes, they do, and they will continue to do so. People with high deductible health policies are still covered by an insurer who's negotiating with providers. So this just adds to our toolkit of cost containment. It doesn't substitute for all the other tools we have available. Now, great, this encourages cost-sensitive consumption, but you think, gee, does that mean that we're being penny-wise and pound-foolish? What about people who might not consume preventive care and cost a lot more down the long run? Well, health savings accounts and the high deductible policies that go along with them allow preventive care to be covered first dollar. And in fact, a study by the GAO of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program showed that FEHB policies that were high deductible policies were more likely to offer preventive care at a more generous rate than other insurance policies under the same umbrella. So now I hope I've convinced you that, in fact, spending would be affected by people having more of these accounts. People would be more cost conscious. But does that expose people to too much financial risk? Are we erring too far on the side of putting the burden on individuals? And what about low-income people who can't afford these high-deductible policies? You hear high-deductible policy, it sounds expensive. Well, in fact, that's only half of the equation. The other half is that the premiums for these policies are much, much lower. In fact, the premiums are so much lower that unless you hit your deductible every year for 3 or 4 or 5 years in a row, you're saving money. You have more money in your pocket, and especially for low-income families, that's important. They want health insurance protection. They also want to pay their rent and buy food and clothes. So these policies put more money at their disposal to use for other family priorities. We can go through a more specific example, but the typical premium for a high-deductible health policy is a couple $1,000s lower than for a non-high deductible policy, and the deductible is only about $1,500 to $4,000 higher, and the employer is kicking in $1,000 into the health savings account of the typical policy. So really, almost every family is better off under one of these policies. And as it turns out, the enrollees are not particularly healthier, wealthier, or younger than the enrollees in other health policies. The evidence that we have suggests that people signing up represent a wide cross-section of the population. Now, Roy hit upon, and I don't have time to go into, a number of other policies that are also targeted at low-income families in particular. The payroll tax goes disproportionately to low-income people. There is a low-income tax credit, and in fact, making premiums tax-preferred for people who don't have employer insurance also disproportionately benefits low-income people because they're more likely to work for employers who don't offer them insurance. I won't go through the example now, but the point is that even for families with very high expenditures, they are, if anything, only slightly worse off under the HSA, and in most cases, much better off in terms of just having more money in their pockets while still having financial protection. Now, you might also think, okay, that's all well and good for people who don't have employer insurance. What about people who do have employer insurance? Is this going to cause employers to drop coverage? Well, in fact, employers are dropping coverage now, and it's because healthcare is so expensive. We've seen a 10 percentage point decline in the number of employers offering health insurance, and that's going to keep going unless there's an affordable policy available. The recent AHIP survey that was just mentioned shows that a third of employers offering health savings accounts were not offering any insurance before. People are getting access to insurance where they did not have it. The last piece is, are people actually able to make better decisions? Are we just giving them more money and they're going to spend it in the same inefficient ways that we've seen healthcare spending before? The answer, again, is no. If people have adequate information and have information not only about costs but about quality, we have ample evidence that they make better healthcare decisions than a bureaucratic system that dictates which things are covered and which things aren't. Even in cases of emergencies like cardiac care, we see that if better information is available about the quality of hospitals and the value, the cost versus the benefits, people make better decisions. So the government needs to lead the way in getting that information to people, both through the FEHB program, through Medicare, and through fostering public-private alliances to get people the information they need to really take advantage of these accounts. So the ultimate goal can definitely be reached through these proposals. The ultimate goal is to get people in a place where they're evaluating the cost versus the benefits of the care available to them, and they're not only allocating health care dollars better, dollars are going to higher value care, but they're also getting to choose whether they want health care or rent based on the value of that care. And we're not there yet, but I think we'll get there.
Very good. Thanks very much, Kate. Next, we hear from Uwe Reinhardt, who's on the faculty at Princeton. He's a frequent panelist at Alliance Briefings, I'm pleased to say. He's a prolific writer, a memorable speaker, and has been sharing his opinions on HSAs and related mechanisms for a number of years. And we look forward to hearing some of those opinions and his reactions to the proposals that are on the table this afternoon. Uwe?
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm going to focus on the ethical facet of this proposal. I work in health policy in many different countries, developed and developing, and I've noticed the difference between us and the way they do policy. They usually begin with a distributive ethic that they want to observe, view that as a constraint, and then make the technical parameters of their policies subject to that. For example, in Germany, it's the principle of social solidarity. They will then say a certain policy is cool, but it violates that principle, so we won't look at it. In the U.S., our tendency tends to be to debate policies in terms of technical parameters, cost sharing, skin in the game, this and that, and then sort of let the ethics fall where they may, which I personally find not very acceptable. That's not what we teach in schools of public policy. So I think the expectation might have been that I would engage in a sort of a discussion on technical matters and using judiciously picked empirical evidence on the price elasticity of demand, what kinds of services consumers, formerly patients, will forego under high deductibles. All of these issues, I don't want to run through them, but basically focus on technical issues. So I decided to be a skunk at the garden party and say, I'd like to explore what the ethical implications of this approach were if we embraced it the way President Bush would like us to embrace it. And I would argue that if it is widely adopted, it will have the following effects. It'll make health care cheaper in absolute dollars for high-income Americans than for low-income Americans. That's implicit in the progressive tax structure. And, of course, now the president says, well, I'm doing that because I want to level the playing field. But I would quibble with him a little bit about it. If it were leveling the playing field, he would have adopted the Kogan-Harbert-Kessler proposal, which makes all out-of-pocket spending tax-deductible, regardless of what kind of insurance policy you have. Then you would have employed and non-employed on an equal level, and insured and non-insured services on an equal level. What the president is doing is something quite different. He is saying, I'm going to tax some tax Americans, and with the tax money, I will reward only those Americans who buy the health insurance policy I, the president, prefer them to have, no matter what they themselves might prefer. This is really more social engineering through the tax code, which Doug Holtz-Eakin, the former CBO head, not a Democrat, said is an egregious misuse of the tax code. And I would say, in general, behavior modification through the tax code is something that economists generally don't like. If you look at this yesterday we had on the Kaiser Commission on the Uninsured and Medicaid, this slide was presented. Among people with less than $30,000, they're in fairly low marginal tax brackets. And the way I describe it is if I have a really rip-roaring toothache and I need a root canal, in where I live, it's about $1,000 to get a root canal and another $1,000 for the crown. When I pay that out of the HSA, it'll cost me at most $600, because if you add up all these taxes that I face at the margin, for every dollar I put into the HSA, cost me only at most 60 cents. The gas station attendant, the waitress, the Walmart worker, it costs them around $900 for the same root canal and after-tax dollars. I personally think that's an ethical proposition that we should debate. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but I do argue that it should be openly debated. This is not neutral. The second issue is we are looking, obviously this is meant to be a cost control and benefit cost control device, but we are looking mainly to the lower part of the national income distribution to do the belt tightening and to do all this stuff. And those are, of course, as I mentioned, I always do, never fail to remind you, those are the people to whom America looks to go abroad to fight. It is not our children. It is, I mean, and our son did, but that's almost weird. It isn't the elite's children who do the fighting. It is mainly people in the lower half, not the very poorest, but in the lower half of the incomes who fight for us. So they bear already the blood and financial burden of the war, and we want to load that on top of them. I personally think we should debate that. How much can you load on these wonderful people? And the third, and this is the income distribution of the United States, 2002, 33% have an annual income of $40,000 or less. Interestingly, most health policy wonks and policymakers are in the upper two, and the bulk of them in the upper three, upper two. Think about it. If you are a young professional and you are married to another young professional, you're up there. That's what I tell my students. You're going to be living up there. You're not part of American society as it reveals itself in the hinterland at all. And so we have these images of skin in the game and so on. But I would say someone with a $200,000 family income, is anyone here willing to tell me that their healthcare behavior would be even in the slightest impacted by a $4,000 deductible? I know it because I've always had them. Not at all. This is peanuts. It's a skiing trip. A waitress and a husband with $40,000 or less income, $4,000 and then more on top of it, is a huge hit. They will modify. So it's fair to say we're looking through the bottom half of the income distribution to carry the load of cost containment in American healthcare. I saw this in Business Week. One in four workers makes less than $18,000. If they're married, that's 40. So I go to e-health insurance where you buy these individual policies, the farmer's market of that. And I made myself a 35-year-old woman, no husband, three kids. That's what I put in. Pick Dallas, Texas, because that's where the National Center for Policy Analysis is. So I said, see what you can get there. And what you see is policies, if she's healthy, I think if she's sick in that market, she'd have trouble getting it because they're underwritten. But if she's not, she can get a policy for $148 a month, a $10,000 deductible. Those are the deductibles that you find on that website. And Diane already walked you through this. And I say, surely we don't believe a family with an annual income of $20,000 will respond to a $10,000 deductible the same way you and I would if we have $200,000. So what I'm arguing is, I think, unassailable. Now, of course, you could avoid this by making the deductible and maximum risk exposure, linking it to income. So that would say if a household with $40,000 can bear a deductible of $4,000 and a maximum risk exposure, say, of $6,000, it would mean that for congressmen and policy wonks, that deductible should be $20,000 with a maximum exposure of $30,000. Then you would have the same sensation of empowerment, or whatever you may call that, that the waitress and her husband will have. So it means all the Congress, the entire Congress, should have a minimum deductible of $20,000. It would mean executives of corporations shouldn't have any health insurance at all. Because when you make $20 million, why do you need insurance? Ask yourself. Yet, I saw this in the New York Times. Here is Mr. Weil, probably worth paid $30 million that year. He had $61,000 out-of-pocket dental and health insurance. The company paid it, and because it's imputable income, they paid his taxes too. And there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago. Many, many corporate executives have first-dollar coverage. Corporation pays everything plus the taxes they're on. And I personally sort of think, do these people who are so risk-averse and such an entitlements mentality as you have in the corporate suites ever think what they're saying when they say people should have more skin in the game? Right? That is sort of, to me, it's a form of Marie Antoinetteism that you see. And finally, there is no question that we are talking about shifting the financial burden of ill health more out of the households of the chronically healthy to the chronically sick. I saw this. This must be Jerry Anderson's study. I don't know who's actually. It isn't Martin Spykov. But more than half of healthcare spending is on behalf of multiple chronic conditions. And Catherine pointed out that, in fact, this is 2001 per capita health spending of insured, privately insured people below 65. Ken Thorpe gave me these numbers. And you could see if you had a $4,000 deductible, in fact, the bulk of Americans would, in fact, be saving money. But the people who are chronically ill, year after year after year, would have to pay this deductible. It doesn't take much to do that. So my concluding, timing is perfect, Ed. My concluding remarks are, I can style the HSA, HD, high deductible, as a liberation from the shackles of government regulation or private health plans, managed care. And it is often marketed that way. I saw this thing, reclaiming personal power and freedom in decision-making. That sounds mellow, and it sounds good. It's a way to market this idea. But I could also say, I could present it to the nation the way it is now being presented, proposed by the president. One can describe it fairly as one more policy designed to redistribute economic privilege, speak tax cuts and healthcare resources upward in the nation's income distribution. That's another way to describe it. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. Maybe we up there are very meritorious and should have these privileges. But I plead only for an open and honest discussion of these ethical facets and not just reduce it to a technical discussion. I particularly take some umbrage of the issue of skin in the game. Particularly, it's often pronounced by people who don't really know what that would mean because they're in an income class where there's no skin in the game. So that's where I am at.
Just so you'll know, with the Uwe's time was roughly equivalent to the first presentations. I tried to do my Jim Lehrer imitation from the presidential debates. We're now going to get a little bit of actual experience with these folks, not theoretical analyses from any perspective or ethical judgments. Frank McCardle is the manager of the Washington, D.C. Research Office of Hewitt Associates, which is described as a global human resources outsourcing and consulting firm. Hewitt provides services to large employers and their workers. They consult with 2,400 companies. They administer benefit programs to millions of employees and retirees worldwide. In addition, you ought to know that Frank is no stranger to Capitol Hill himself. He served on the professional staff of the Senate Aging Committee. And we're going to hear from him today about some of the experience HSAs and Hewitt have had with their clients over these first 2 years of experience. Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. And the first thing I want to say is, Uwe, the next time I need a root canal, I'm going to drive up to Princeton because it's a lot cheaper up there than it is down in Washington, at least based on my last one.
Really?
Yeah. Ed kindly did an introduction for us, so the agenda that we have is basically to look very quickly at the current market, and by this I mean the large employer market with 1,000 or more employees, and you have to pay attention to that definition because even in the AHIP materials just released, they'll refer to a large group as having 50 or more employees. So we're really talking about the very big companies that are the most likely to provide health benefits. So talk about the prevalence, what employers and employees see in these programs, and also some areas where things might need to change in the future. In terms of high deductible health plans, we have data of our own from large employers, and it's not a random sample, but I've compared it to the data in KFF HRET, and it actually lines up pretty well with what they have there. And basically what this data shows is that roughly a third of large employers now have a high deductible health plan plus an account. That account is not necessarily an HSA. It can also be an HRA, as Diane explained. And HRAs often have more flexibility for employers than an HSA. About half are considering it for a future date, and one out of five basically have no interest at all. Now, this is looking at the HSA with a qualified high deductible plan, and here the percentages are lower. We have about 8% who are currently offering a high deductible health plan along with an HSA, and 5% are adopting one in 2006. Now, in this market, when it's offered the HSA, 90% of the time it's offered an option alongside other options that the company offers. And the vast majority of these situations apply to salaried employees, not to bargained employees. I don't know in the private sector of any situation yet where it's been applied to bargained employees, but I may have missed that. The employee participation we're offered in an HSA is pretty modest. That's because, in part, it's offered as part of an option. As I said, you can get some higher situations where there's more participation, and generally, if the employer is contributing to the HSA, you'll get some higher participation. But it's not unusual for us to see in the first year of an option like this that the enrollment might be 2 to 5%. And again, that's a first-year effect, but we'll be watching that in the future. Now, why employers may want a high deductible plan with an HRA or an HSA There really is, as I think you've heard from the previous speakers, a strong assumption on the part of employers that if you give people money to manage themselves, they will be more careful in how they use that and how they spend it. And indeed, looking at the KFF HRET data, a majority of employers say that this kind of a plan is going to be effective in reducing cost growth. 16% said very effective, and 45% said somewhat effective. And next week, the National Business Group on Health is having a conference called Consumers in Charge, Transforming Healthcare. So I just cite that to let you know that businesses, and it's not just the C-suite, think that there's promise in this approach. The other point, and I think maybe Roy and Kate made this, is we often read that people are going to forego wellness care or preventive care, and that's not the case. In fact, we would design a plan with a company encouraging them to provide generous preventive benefits, because what they want, what we want, is to have the employee be healthy and to manage their care well. And so sometimes you'll see it provided with a zero deductible. It's going to depend a lot on the plan design. And it's also a way, the foundation and Hewitt have done a lot of work on retiree health. There's also a way, at the beginning at least, people were very excited about it, less so now, of maybe this being a way to accumulate assets for future health care needs. And then another reason they do it is because it appeals to employees. Employees like the lower employee contributions. Our data shows when you hear data about savings from going from one plan to another, you have to really dig in a little bit and say, what kind of plan are they leaving and what kind of plan are they going to? So to try and hold that constant, we looked at a PPO design where everything was basically the same, but you went from a $500 deductible to a $1,500 deductible. And there, the premium savings were in the range of 15 to 20%. Employees like it because it's tax effective. And, you know, having worked in the retirement area as well, you know, a lot of young employees don't want to plan too much for the future. But if they have a way that they can get a tax effective way to save money, it can appeal to that spectrum more effectively, perhaps, than what we do now. Also, it gives them a freedom that they can spend the dollars to fit their needs in the way they fit their needs. And Uwe referred to that, but I think it's important that people have that feeling that they have control over it. And then again, they see it as perhaps a chance to accumulate assets. The reason I think the penetration to date among the large employer market has been relatively modest, those reasons are shown on this slide. One reason is that prescription drugs are generally subject to the high deductible. And I can tell you from working with companies and their employees, that's a showstopper for a lot of employees. And that helps explain, too, that where the company puts it in, why you might get more modest participation. It's also unclear, but there are IRS regs pending, to the extent that employers can vary contributions for low-income people or for those who are chronically ill. And we're hopeful that we'll get the permission to do that in the near future. Also, an HSA, as Diane explained, can be used for other purposes, whereas an alternative arrangement, the HRA, can be conditioned for healthcare-only uses. And some companies say, we don't want to put money in this account, and then at the end of the day, have the employee be able to use it for some purpose other than healthcare. And I think there are other reasons here. You can't use a flexible spending account along with it right now very effectively. You can't roll over these HRA balances at all. And the limits on contributions that Diane mentioned, the lower of the deductible or the permitted amount, permitted maximum, really makes it hard to accumulate much given current healthcare needs as you're going along. In this slide, there are some of the administration proposals that are considered very helpful. Increasing the HSA maximum contribution would allow for more accumulation, and employers could convert their existing HRAs to an HSA. They could make higher contributions, as Roy explained, for people with chronic illness, and this hasn't got as much attention, and I'd love to hear more details about it, but enabling portable insurance policies that the employee could actually carry from one employer to the next I think is a potentially fascinating idea, but again, we'd love to hear more about the details. The employers like very much what the administration is saying about transparency and what that means in terms of disclosing information about prices and quality. But there's also, you know, Diane put up these big numbers about the cost. I think there's also concern about the cost and maybe some worry that will we have to pay for this in another way. There are also some other areas where employers would like to see even further action. One of them is permitting coverage of drugs outside the high deductible. Again, varying the contributions and being able to coordinate some of these other programs with HSAs and allowing a rollover of the FSA for a limited amount. But I want to talk about the last two in particular because I think they stretch the conversation a little bit. And one is people are thinking about how you can put more flexibility in the design so that it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a high deductible health plan, but yet it will have consumers spending their money more carefully and more wisely. And I have to say that even when we look at account-based plans, it's not the account per se that we think that really drives the behavioral change. It has to be accompanied with tools for the employee to understand the differences in cost, when a generic might be more appropriate than a brand and vice versa, to be able to see which doctors are in their network that are both higher quality and more cost effective. So we think that combining those tools with the account can reduce trend, healthcare trend, by 1 or 2 percentage points over time, but you have to get that behavioral effect. The last thing is that, again, referring to our experience with retiree health, many companies are taking away benefits for future retirees, in particular new hires. But these companies are also concerned they'll make their plan available when the employee reaches retirement age, but how are they going to pay for it, the employees? And so they would like to see some dedicated kind of account, not tied to any kind of health plan that they could use for that purpose. So in conclusion, account-based plans are seen as very important and interest is growing, but contrary a little bit to what you see in the small employer market, it's been growing more slowly among the very large employers. Generally, these plans are not full replacement plans. They're within an option, as I said. We know of instances where they are a full replacement plan, and we're going to look at those very carefully. But in two of the cases that I know of, the replacement plan is very generous, and one is which basically the company is saying, we're going to put in exactly what we put in before, but we're hoping for this behavioral effect over time to help reduce our costs. And then, in my opinion, with only 2 years of experience, you can't forecast too much about the cost and utilization of HSAs. We'll need a little bit more time for that, but that certainly won't stop many people from forecasting, and it probably won't stop me either from forecasting. But it also takes time to clear up some misconceptions. There was a hearing in Senate Finance the other day where a very learned witness, very expert, said that somebody could accumulate money in their HSA and then use it for cosmetic dental care. Well, the rules prohibit that. It has to be a code-approved medical expense, and cosmetic activities are not code-approved. So as I indicated, I think some of these proposals from the administration employers will find as very attractive, but they're still looking for some additional flexibility along the lines that I described. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Get to the point here where you get a chance to speak up. Remind you, excuse me, that you have green question cards. If you would like to write out a question, hold it up, and a staff person will snatch it from your fingers. There are microphones here and over to the left. I don't think there's one over here, is there? And you can use that. Oh, yes, there is. Plenty of opportunities to voice your questions. Before we do that, could we, if any of the speakers would like to make a quick observation in response to anything they've heard, that would be appropriate at this point. You want to, Kate?
Sure. I'd like to very briefly respond to Uwe's very important and well-taken points, but I think he paints a world in which low-income people are giving up hospital care so that Sandy Weill can have more expensive dental surgery. And I reject that characterization of the set of proposals on the table, as do I reject the nickname Marie. So the advantage to low-income people of these plans being available is that they have the option of a basic health policy plan that's more affordable, that their employer is more likely to offer, and that they're more likely to be able to pay the premiums for, leaving them extra resources to spend on other family priorities. So I think it's important when thinking about whether these proposals are good for people at different parts of the income distribution to think about access to the basic care that we think everyone should have access to, not restricting people to the very benefit-rich plans that some people have that they may not find affordable and that their employers may not offer them at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to be construed as being against high-deductible plans that people may want. My wife and I have had them for 20 years at Princeton, and if low-income people want them, sure. But, you know, to use taxpayers' money, because let's face it, we're borrowing everything from China now, but at some point, U.S. taxpayers have to pay off the deficit. So it is taxpayer money. To use taxpayer money to reward well-to-do people disproportionately for this behavior change is something that I question. And that's, you know, I mean, if poor people voluntarily want to have a high deductible policy, I'd be the last person as an economist to stand in their way. But to use tax money for behavior modification, which essentially is once again not regressive, but in absolute dollars funnels more money to the upper income groups, people like me, is something that I think at least should be debated. I mean, you may want to do this. I have my own view. They were shaped in Europe and Canada. But I don't want to impose my views on you other than to say, that's what you're doing. That is what you're doing. You're giving very little tax support to the waitress, and you're giving a lot to the lawyer and economist.
Yes, why don't we get started with the questions?
Hi, I'm Laura Truman with the Coalition for Affordable Health Coverage. And my question has to do with the income levels of people who are purchasing health savings accounts. What we're hearing doesn't seem to comport with what Mr. Reinhart is saying, in that this benefits the rich. Just yesterday, I talked to a very modest income widow with three kids. She got a health savings account because she was paying $900 a month in a premium. Her premium went down to $350, and she had had a $2,000 deductible before that. I talked to a fellow hardcore Democrat in Baltimore. He doesn't like Bush, but he was uninsured for 2 years after he went out on his own to start his own human resources consulting business, had a very modest income while he started his business, and finally got insurance because of health savings accounts. So it seems to me that the real question is, who is it helping? And I wonder if the panelists could talk to the data about who is purchasing it, what the income levels are, because that was not in the AHIP study.
From many angles. My recollection of the data is that about a third of purchasers had incomes under $50,000. So that's not so different from what the overall pool looks like. We're seeing enrollment in high deductible HSA policies that looks roughly the same along income distribution, age of the person signing up, self-reported health of the person signing up. But I also agree with the point that these are very new policies. And so we don't have a lot of great data, a lot of really rich data on who's signing up. But we also have good information that these are appealing to a wide cross-section of the population. And that's my read of the current preliminary data.
Can I do a quick follow-up? What was fascinating about what you said, I thought, was the striking difference in the premium in this new policy for a roughly comparable policy. And I wonder if it was a comparable policy, how that squares with Frank's findings that there are savings on the order of 15 to 20%, as opposed to two-thirds
I think, though, we looked at Kaiser yesterday, and these were, Diane, what survey that was, that the premium differentials in the employers were there, but they were nothing of this substantial. I mean, one-third, they were not. Remember these numbers? We have them somewhere here. But they were nothing like it. But to your point, I think you misunderstand again. I do not wish to stand in the way of poor people being able to buy high deductible policy at all. Not at all. What I question or want you to think about, to use taxpayers' money to reward someone like me more in absolute dollars for buying the policy the president wants me to buy than to reward the waitress in absolute dollars. That's what I question, which has nothing to do with the point you raise.
But to put that in the context of the way our policy works today, right now we spend more than $150 billion a year subsidizing high-income people's purchase of health insurance, only through employers, though. If you have access to employer-provided insurance, you get a subsidy, and that's paid for through taxes to the tune of about $150 billion a year. What these proposals suggest is extending the same tax benefits to people who don't have access to employer-provided insurance, which happen to be disproportionately low-income people, providing refundable tax credit to people who don't currently get tax benefits through their employer, to let people get the payroll tax refunded, which, again, disproportionately benefits low-income people. So let's not forget that these tax benefits, we are doing this through the tax system, but that's against the backdrop where we're doing much more of that through the tax system now, and we're extending those benefits to people who don't currently get them.
But you see, that is why many of us, myself included, Stuart Butler at the Heritage Foundation, have for years argued that in theory, ideally, we would like to get rid of this tax preference in the employment-based system. And since that is extremely difficult, even technically, to do, I just had an exchange with Stuart Butler on it, at least capping it, sort of going the other way. What you did is you took an existing inequity and extended it, but extended it only to those people who do what you want them to do, rather than to everyone. Then you should have gone the Kogan, Hubbard, Kessler. At least they are logically consistent, saying, okay, we're going to extend the inequity to everyone. But you do a mixture of it. You extend the inequity and use it as behavior modification.
Yeah, I think when you design any kind of program like this, you have to pay special attention to low-income people. I mean, that's undeniable. But I just wonder, when it comes to the HSAs or the high deductible plans, in the retirement realm, there's a thing like the Retirement Savers Credit, it's called. It was passed a few years ago. It's going to be extended. The Democrats supported it very strongly. And it is basically a government matching contribution for low-income people who put money in an IRA or a 401k. So I guess I would say that this issue of low-income people does not have to be a fatal and permanent flaw, but there are designs that could be developed that could address that part of it. It leaves the remaining question of whether you want that kind of behavioral change or not.
Ian, you've got about 3 days' worth of questions there on cards, and then we'll get to the questioner at the microphone.
We have a series of questions that all speak to the need for the consumer to have perfect information to make the kinds of decisions that they would need to be making in a cost-effective way. One has asked whether or not it is a strategy that where you should actually post all the physician fees, and what are you doing to provide the tools that the consumer would need these policies to be effective?
The president is very interested in that topic and has met privately with CEOs of insurance companies, large employers, and medical providers to urge them to start doing so voluntarily. This is an area in our health economy that is very different from the rest of our economy, where we seldom know what the price is before we go have treatment done. And sometimes when we ask, we're told, why do you care? You're not paying for it. We'd like that to change. And to help show the way, we're going to be asking Medicare, federal employees, and the TRICARE programs to to start telling their enrollees what it costs before they get actual medical treatment so that we can start to change that dynamic, get people used to asking about price and being more sensitive to price going forward. We need to do that also with quality information so that individuals can have a good valued discussion, but we are probably a little bit further ahead on the quality side than we are on the price side. So moving in parallel tracks to start making that happen.
I think the image that everyone has first dollar coverage and has absolutely no interest in the health bill, I don't know how many people still have that. Many people are in PPOs where you're very much exposed. So if you don't go to someone in the network, you'd really like to know their prices, but it's the information for all the folks who were in PPO, the market has never provided that information. There's very little information on the web on drugs, cost effectiveness. You know, is Nexium really that much better than Prilosec? Now, there was a Blue Cross invented Rx Intelligent in 2000 that was supposed to do cost effectiveness analysis for drugs and post them. And the website still exists. I just looked it up. Great fanfare, Wall Street Journal, everyone reported it. But the organization is dead. It's defunct. The phone number belongs to someone in the accounting department now. So here again, what I believe, like most economists, that patients, call them consumers, should have information, particularly on the quality of care of individual providers and hospitals, and also on fees. And it's been promised for 20 years. And maybe this time around it will come. But I wouldn't bet the farm on it. It's very difficult to do, number one. And then there is great reluctance to have transparency in prices in the American health system. The docs and the hospitals will fight you tooth and nail. I have a proposal in your package of how this could be done for hospitals. DRGs for every hospital, for every patient, and each hospital can set its own conversion factor and post it. If I were, I could just see the AHA go nuts over the very idea of forcing that much competition. You saw the airlines who now want the transportation department to allow them to bill a basic fee, a fuel fee, an airport fee to depackage so that students can so easily price shop. And that's actually going to be granted, I think, by the Department of Transportation. Providers don't like this. And they're powerful, and they will fight you every step of the way in the quest for price transparency. They've succeeded for 20 years to keep that, particularly Hannibal, off the gates. And we'll just see. So maybe 5 years from now, we'll all be delighted, and we all have these websites. At the moment, show me where it exists.
Hi, I'm Deborah Mazier with the Ways and Means Committee, and I just wanted to make a couple of points relative to the last question that was asked. One of them is that in my research on high-deductible health plans, I've noticed that a lot of high-deductible policies don't cover maternity coverage, and it seems to me that one of the reasons why you might get lower premiums in high-deductible plans is because there are certain benefits that are carved out. I just want everyone in the room to be cautious about how they're talking about high-deductible plans, because many of those policies might not actually be comparable to the coverage that is offered today in other markets. The other point is, since the panelists from the White House invoked the GAO study that my boss co-requested on the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, I wanted to point out that the front-line findings from GAO were that, indeed, enrollees in high-deductible health plans in the Federal Employees Benefits Program were higher income and younger than enrollees in the rest of the Federal Employees Plan. So we do actually have some evidence now, based on the Federal Employees experience, that higher income people and younger people are more attracted to these schemes. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Many people say that high-deductible plans cover preventive services, so this question just asks, are there any data to support this? Do we know to what extent they are included?
No, we don't have any really good data to know whether every high-deductible policy is offering preventive care without being subject to the deductible. The law clearly allows them to do so, and we believe that many policies are, in fact, doing that. The GAO study certainly indicated on the federal employees that it is the case. If I could just quickly respond to the last question, whether or not maternity coverage is offered or not is a very common question in the individual market for insurance. It's not specific to HSAs. And related to the GAO report, if you took out retirees in that study, the age difference was 44 and 47, not 46 and 59. Retirees are not eligible for HSAs, and it's not fair to put that in the universe.
Can I follow up on that for just a second?
Good.
One of the things that the Hewitt findings showed was that employers are reluctant to move in this direction in part because of the prescription drug coverage under the deductible, which makes it a whole lot tougher. Now, you've come a long way to make them more attractive to chronically ill people. Is this something that the administration is still considering, or is it beyond the pale, or is it going to be added to the package?
I've had many discussions with employers about whether or not prescription drug coverage should be offered below the deductible. And one of the usual tactics is to try to expand the definition of what is preventive care. And the arguments go somewhere along the lines of, well, prescription drugs prevent people from dying. I don't disagree. Drugs prevent people from having their conditions worsen. I don't disagree. But if we're looking at what a classic definition of preventive care is, it's usually prior to the onset or symptoms of a particular illness or condition, and it is very difficult beyond that point to start drawing a line where things are considered preventive and are not. Treasury did try to indicate that it would be possible for some drugs to be preventive care, noting some cases where people have risk factors, such as high cholesterol, which doesn't necessarily mean you have a disease or illness, but you have risk factors for a condition, and that cholesterol-lowering drugs could be viewed as preventive care under those situations. So I think we have to look, you know, very closely at that. When I've talked with members of Congress who supposedly thought about these issues, they tell me they clearly wanted all Americans to understand what the price of drugs are. And I can tell you from my own experience, the first time my wife filled a prescription for an antibiotic, the pharmacist came to her and said, "Do you know this costs $102? And she said, "Well, yes, we have a high deductible plan and I expect to pay the full cost." Well, it was a name brand of amoxicillin. And afterwards, she realized that she probably could have asked for a generic version of amoxicillin, would have spent much less. And that is, at least some of the supporters in Congress of HSAs clearly wanted that effect to be there and believe that that would be diminished if it was if drugs were allowed below the deductible.
I agree with Roy that the political odds of getting this done are quite small, particularly this year. It is helpful to have preventive drugs available for coverage, but you also have to think about how you communicate that to employees and how employees actually understand that drug A could be covered but drug B not. It's very difficult to communicate and for them to understand. And then the bigger issue is whether you differentiate drugs at all, and I guess I would argue that you do. We know from a health status standpoint that there are a lot of problems with people not complying with their medication regimen. We know that adherence is often very spotty, and as you also mentioned, the chronic conditions are rising as such a big part of our healthcare costs. So I think the companies feel that this is a sector where you want to encourage compliance and with the regimen and preventing and dealing with some of these chronic illnesses and not put any kind of financial barrier in the way of that.
This question is regarding the implications of the growth of HSAs on the risk pool, and is there any concern about the potential fragmentation of the risk pool as a result of the acceleration?
So that's an important question, because the goal of any insurance regime is to get people pooling their risk together so that healthy people and sick people contribute to a common fund, and then when you get sick, you have access to resources. Right now, there are a lot of uninsured people who don't have access to health insurance, and when they're healthy, it doesn't seem worth the money, and when they're sick, it's hard to get it. So one of the goals of this expansion is to get healthy people into the system, able to afford a basic insurance policy, and then be in the system and pooled with other people. On the employer side, as I mentioned before, we see employer erosion of coverage now because of rising costs. So again, anything that keeps employers in the market of offering health insurance helps with risk. Now, as Uwe has alluded to, I think if we were designing a system de novo, we wouldn't set up the system we have. There are problems with having risk pooled through employers. People who get sick can't change jobs, so you have something we call job lock, where people are stuck in their jobs just because somebody in their family is sick and they feel like they can't get insurance from another source. So we have also proposals that we didn't have time to talk about today to make it easier for people to keep their insurance when they move from one employer to another. So all of this is about keeping people insured so that we do have better risk pooling. And anything that we can do to make the non-employer individual market function better, to make it more appealing to people who can't currently afford insurance or who don't see a basic policy available to them, will improve risk pooling.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Megan Smith. I'm with Edelman Healthcare. I have a couple questions back on the transparency point, if I could. Roy, you spoke about meeting with the insurance companies and asking them to do this kind of divulgence on a voluntary basis, noting that Uwe's concerns and others that this is very hard information to receive. It's been suggested in the media that possible legislation could come out of this, and in essence of that, maybe a standard of the types and kinds of information that would be provided so that the information provided by all these individual companies voluntarily would be uniform. Can you speak to that a little bit?
We note that some insurance companies have already started doing this. You may have read in the Wall Street Journal about Aetna's experiment in Cincinnati, providing the information on the 25 most common procedures performed by physicians in their offices being available to their enrollees. Most of the major insurance companies have plans if they're not already doing these types of things, so we believe those are steps in the right direction. If we can get Medicare's information out there, in theory, every American would have access to how much Medicare is paying. We absolutely note that there are four bills pending in Congress which would require this, at least of hospitals and in some cases ambulatory surgery centers. Those are steps in the right direction. The President could call on Congress to enact those bills as steps that we could take to move further down this road. It's not going to happen overnight, as Dr. Reinhart suggested, but we've got to start somewhere. It's not going to be perfect, but we've got to start somewhere. So we're trying to take some meaningful steps in moving the market that much further down the road still this year.
But just to illustrate how hard this is, Medicare has, of course, a fee schedule that, at least in theory, is somewhat based on relative cost. And some years ago, a fellow in Phoenix tried to have a website where you could get Medicare physician fees for Phoenix, for Princeton, et cetera, and have at least some idea what things cost when you're in a PPO, so you could tell a doctor, hey, three times is a little too much. And it turns out the AMA has a patent right over the CPT-4 code that underlies the Medicare, and they wanted to charge him a royalty for every hit. And he had a very angry website with that contract, I have it somewhere still, that was written where the Medicare fee schedule nomenclature actually belongs to the AMA. And, of course, they didn't want this information out or make money off it, whatever the motive was, and he couldn't make a go of. And he was a great entrepreneur, I thought. I could see the potential, you know, advertise and so on. But this never came because I'm kind of interested. I have a PPO. We have a PPO with a high deductible and this flexible spending account, which in my tax bracket is a wonderful thing, except, as I always tell people, I had to go consume a colonoscopy on Christmas Eve to burn down this account. This is a true story.
But HSA would be so much better.
I mean, the HSA is, in fact, a role over FSA, which, so I appreciate it very much, you know, for myself. But don't underestimate the ingenuity the providers will bring to the table to block price transparency.
We have much work to do.
Yeah.
Well, actually, as a follow-up to this last comment, this question says, rather than a tool to curb the use of health care, couldn't HSAs promote the overuse of spending since the account would have the ability to discretionary spend on the employer's contribution?
So first, I want to clarify that the goal isn't necessarily to get people to spend less. It's to get our healthcare dollars to go further. And we have a lot of evidence that our healthcare dollars are not buying us nearly as much as they should because people don't have the information that they need and physicians don't have the information that they need. So you can see we spend a lot more than other countries on healthcare and our outcomes are not measurably better along a lot of dimensions. And then even within the U.S., if you look at parts of the country where we spend a lot more, say through Medicare, we don't see any better outcomes, even if you control for the age and the risk and the preferences of the population. You spend twice as much per Medicare beneficiary in Miami as you do in Minneapolis. That person does not live longer. That person does not live better. That person is not even happier. They just get more care. So the goal is to set up a system where we can allocate our health dollars to where they do the most good. And then if we're spending this much on health care, everybody could be healthier and wealthier. So if that's the goal, then will people consume more of some health care with an HSA? Yes, I hope so. And I hope other people will consume less or resources will go to different places. And then I'll be less concerned about the total amount that we're spending because I'll know we're getting our money's worth. We don't care how much we spend on consumer electronics because we're buying things that are worth it to us. Whereas in healthcare right now, sometimes we are and sometimes we're not. And unless we have better information on the table, we're not getting as much value for our spending as we could.
You know, Catherine is unduly modest. She wrote a dynamite article, April 7, 2004, Health Affairs, if I remember correctly, where she related data on process quality to data on health spending for the elderly and gets a negative correlation. I recommend that piece to you. I use it all the time. I should pay royalties.
Yes, and I should say, by the way, as we're winding down here, remember these blue evaluation forms. They'll help us make these programs better. Yes, go ahead, Alwyn.
Hi, Alwyn Castle with the Center for Studying Health System Change. And speaking to Dr. Reinhart's point, I guess I am in possession of a little-known secret, and that is that you can go to the American Medical Association website, and I think once you agree that you will not misuse the CPT codes, you can get up to 10 CPT codes a day by geographic area that will tell you how much Medicare pays for those CPT codes in a physician's office and in a facility, and it's fascinating. I think you need to keep in mind, though, that we know that private plan rates vary significantly across communities as a percentage of the Medicare fee schedule. So in some communities that we study, Little Rock, for example, the docs get 150% of the Medicare fee schedule, whereas in Phoenix they get 100% and they consider themselves lucky. Now, that was my observation. I actually do have a question, and I want to offer a disclaimer that I have a journalism degree, and, you know, I certainly have been accused of practicing economics without a license, but the basic question I have is, if you want to curtail or slow the trend of healthcare spending, why would you possibly subsidize it at a higher level? Because isn't that just basic econ 101? The more you subsidize something, the more people are going to use it.
Your econ 101 is right on, that when something is subsidized relative to something else, we expect a distortion in the consumption. Right now, employer-provided insurance is subsidized relative to out-of-pocket spending. So I'll get there. So you see that people, in fact, consume all their health care through employer-sponsored insurance if they have it and not through out-of-pocket spending. So now we're saying let's level the playing field. Let's make out-of-pocket spending have the same tax preference that employer-sponsored insurance does. And your question is, are people going to consume more of that? Well, I think there are three avenues through which we're going to see people's behavior changed and a reallocation of resources towards higher value care. First is when people are more price sensitive, we've seen evidence from other sectors of medical spending and the economy more broadly, like LASIK surgery, like in vitro fertilization, like dental care, like vision care, where when people are more price sensitive, providers compete more and you get both increases in quality and decreases in price. So we expect provider competition to be a big force in that direction. We also expect that when people have a choice about how to allocate their resources, they'll be allocated more efficiently. And so we'll see a decrease in quantity, although I think the change in price is going to be the bigger longer run effect. The third effect is that right now, and I think this is the big one, but one that we're not going to see in the first 5 years or even probably 10 years, is that right now there's no incentive to develop cost-saving technologies. So you see, if you're an innovator and you have a new way to do something we can already do, but it costs half as much, there's very little incentive to develop that because people aren't price sensitive to choose that. If, on the other hand, people are being price sensitive, we'll not only see life-saving technologies, which are great, and I think all the technological innovation we've seen is, on average, wonderful, but you'll also see cost-saving technologies develop the same way we have in computer processors or in LASIK surgery or in vitro fertilization, where in the long run you'll end up getting roughly the same amount of healthcare at a much lower price. And then in the end, you may end up spending more than you spend now or less than you spend now, but I'm not going to be as worried about it because I'll know you'll get your money's worth from it.
And I guess the only thing I would respond with is we're actually looking at some of those self-pay markets right now, and they're often touted as these models of market efficiency. And when you actually begin to look under the rock, there's not a lot of price competition going on, and the urgency of these procedures and whatnot, I mean, there's a big difference between getting a nose job and needing a bypass. And it is not interchangeable. And, you know, healthcare is not hog bellies. It's not a commodity. And if you get prices, that'll be great. But if you don't have the quality information to go along with it, I would argue that we will be penny wise and pound foolish and not get value, which is what I think we're all after.
If I could add, I think you do deserve a degree in economics. I'll give you a certificate later. But you don't have to worry that much about low-income people because we're not giving them much of a subsidy. You got to worry about people like me. You're making it half price.
Well, I thank our research assistants for subsidizing my health care.
So, you know, for me, the price elasticity of health care is very, very low. A, the government pays roughly half of it, plus my income is high. So that's the folks you got to worry about, our social class, not the poor, because we don't give them much.
One more person. Yeah, Alan Glass, Senator Biden. The underlying assumption seems to be that by putting people at financial risk, they will make decisions that are better both for the economy and presumably for their own health. My question to you is anybody concerned about the fact that putting people at financial risk might encourage them not to seek health care when they need it? Is a person who's 60 years old and has chest pain every 2 weeks going to blow it off if they're going to have to pay the first $500 as opposed to if they had a health plan, they'd go see their cardiologist? So does this thing, the HSAs, produce results not only that are good for the economy, but are good for individuals' health?
I'm going to jump in again. That's a great question, and I think that people have a very strong interest in preserving their own health. I don't think that people go to the doctor because we subsidize it. Nobody enjoys a colonoscopy, especially on December 24th, but people have a strong interest in getting the care that's going to make them healthier and live longer. But what they don't have is the information that they need and sometimes the resources that they need. And that's where these policies come in. We have ample evidence that armed with the right information, people do in fact make better healthcare consumption decisions. There are lots of clinical studies, for example, the sports study of spinal surgery choices. There are two different procedures available or two different treatments available if you have a certain kind of back pain. You can have surgery and there are surgical complications and the risk of problems from that, or you can have bed rest and there are problems with bed rest and it takes a longer time. In the end, those two procedures have roughly the same success rate, but with very different risks and complications, and people should choose among them based on what their preferences are for those different risks, given that they're going to have roughly the same outcome. Well, there's a clinical trial that shows if you give people about a half an hour's worth of information on this, they make very different choices. And in fact, many fewer people opt for the surgery than they would otherwise. These are people who had access to the funds to have the surgery, but discovered through the information that was made available to them that they would rather not. And so just providing people with key information really does change consumption patterns. Sometimes they're going to spend more, sometimes they're going to spend less. And we see that people who are specifically in consumer-directed health plans, again, the data is very young, and we can argue about it because they've only been in existence for a few years. But if anything, we see higher compliance with treatment regimes, and we see insurance companies continuing to provide disease management help and programs for their enrollees because they still have a financial stake. Remember, people aren't going without insurance in these plans. They have catastrophic backstops of $5,000, $10,000. The insurance companies still cares about making sure they spend the money wisely, and people are not exposed to an infinite amount of financial risk.
I think I would add the most thorough study of this behavior was some years ago, the Rand Corporation experiment. And Joe Newhouse, about 2 years ago, wrote an article or a year ago in Health Affairs on the Rand experiment and HSAs. And he observed in that study, low-income people facing high cost sharing did neglect high blood pressure, which I think I'm quoting him correctly, said drove up, drove up death rates by 10%. And that is why, of course, as Roy and Catherine both said, and Frank has to get it done, is that the preventive care and this kind of care, asthma for children and high blood pressure, is actually exempt from the high cost sharing, that you actually sort of seduce people into consuming it. But that's a design problem Frank has to solve for us.
All right. Diane, closing comments?
I just want to say that I'm sorry we couldn't get to the very many questions that were left on the table, so I think it speaks to this issue being one that we should continue to keep on the agenda and revisit.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you for coming, and I want you to help me to thank our panelists for a very good discussion.
You were to post those.
And please fill out your blue evaluation forms as you go.
On those we like to answer. Post.